And we're holding on page Nun Gimel in Shabbos, three lines from the bottom, middle of Os Ayin Tes. We were learning about the various dinim and statements about the clothes, the proper way that a Talmid Chacham should dress and act. So one thing we said, we mentioned a Mishnah. Here in Ein Yaakov, it doesn't quote the part of the Gemara, it quotes the Mishnah, but whatever. There's a Mishnah that mentions clothes of Banoyim, where if there's a stain on one side, then it's considered a Chatzitza, and the Gemara defined that, Rabbi Yochanan defined that Banoyim builders means Talmid Chacham. Then in this connection, Rabbi Yochanan said that a Talmid Chacham, the definition of a Talmid Chacham, whom you would return a lost object, the Tvias Ayin, is if he's careful about his shirt to turn it the right side out. So he put it on inside out by mistake. He would make a point of, he would be careful to turn it right side out. So that shows, in other words, among other things, first of all, I mean, it shows that he has the dignity of a Talmid Chacham. Therefore, it means, therefore, we can trust him when he says that he recognizes the sting. It shows that it goes, different posts can talk about it goes together with, or it's, that it goes together with something else that it says in Bava Metzia, that a Talmid Chacham is somebody who always tells the truth except in three particular things. So this would relate to that as well. So now in this connection, the Gemara brings a few other statements of Rabbi Yochanan about the definition of a Talmid Chacham. So for each purpose, in other words, you have a Talmid Chacham is a very generic term for different purposes. In halacha, you have different definitions of that. So the definition that we had, that you can return him a lost object, the Tvias Ayin, just when he says, I recognize it, even though he can't give a particular simon, for that you have the detail that he's careful to turn his shirt the right side out. What is the definition of a Talmid Chacham as far as appointing him a leader of the tzibur in his town, in his community? That would be where you can ask him a matter of halacha any place in all of Shas, and he's able to answer it even in Masechta Kala. Now, what is Masechta Kala? So Rashi explains, Masechta Kala is one of the Masechtas Ketanas. You can find them in a standard Shas. You can find them printed in back of the volume that has Avodah Zarah and Hodias. They're not commonly learnt. So here you have a person who's familiar even with the topics in those. Then it shows that he's a genuine Talmid Chacham. Tosfos points out, on the other hand, the fact is, Masechta Kala is also easy to understand, and there are other places where the Gemara talks about, on the contrary, that you can say a person is a Talmid Chacham even if the only Masechta he knows is Masechta Kala, which is relatively easy to learn. But he was saying the other way around. Tosfos themselves goes on to say another possibility that Masechta Kala might mean the Masechta that they teach at the time of the Yarche Kala, at the time before the Yom Tovim, before Pesach and Sukkos. They would be teaching them the halachas that are relevant to the upcoming Yom Tov. So then if he's familiar at least with that, then he deserves to be appointed a Parnas Alav Tzibur. So in other words, Marashar explains, for this purpose, since you can ask him, so you can have, for example, they appointed him a parnas as far as a particular area of halacha. They might have, for example, that they appointed him to be the specialist in a certain area of halacha. So as long as he's thoroughly familiar with that area, then it doesn't matter if he doesn't know the other halachas. And then Rabbi Yochanan says another different definition of a Talmid Chacham. Eizah Talmid Chacham shebneiro mitzuvim lasis lo melachto. What's the definition of a Talmid Chacham that the people of his town are obligated to do his work on his behalf? And Rashi refers to a Gemara in Yuma that explains like this. On the one hand, we have a pasuk where Hashem tells Moshe to make the Aron. On the other hand, we have the pasuk where it says va'osu Aron, that they should make the Aron. So what is it? In other words, it's Moshe's responsibility, but then in turn, it becomes the responsibility of the tzibur to do that work on his behalf. So what is the definition of a Talmid Chacham for that purpose? That would be a Talmid Chacham who sets aside his own business and he occupies himself with the business of Hashem, of learning Torah, so then Tzibur is required to work on his behalf. However, the Gemara says, now that would only mean insofar as they have to work on his behalf to supply him with bread. which is a basic food, in other words, something which, as Rashi explains, he's busy learning Torah or doing other mitzvahs, and his life depends on it. So then they're obligated to take that up on his behalf. But other kinds of things, either he does without, or he would have to do them himself. So that's a that's another definition of a Talmid Chacham that's relevant for that particular that's relevant for that particular halacha. And Marshall also adds, by the way, that Chafetz Shemayim doesn't necessarily mean only learning Torah. It can also include Kigun B'tzorchei Tzibur. He's busy working on behalf of the Tzibur, so then they're obligated to step up to the plate and then supply him with food for that. Next, the Amar of Yechanan, Ezeru Talmid Chacham. What's another definition of a Talmid Chacham that's relevant for a different purpose? Kol Shesharvin Osa Halacha B'chol Makom B'Omra, where you can ask him a halacha anywhere in all of Shas, and he can answer it. So that would be. So according to Rashi, there's not necessarily a great deal of difference between that and the earlier one where we said about Masechta Kala. Because according to Rashi, the point was Masechta Kala is also part something that B'chol Makom, and it's something that's less common. So according to Rashi, in other words, the Pashtus, we would have to say that here we're talking about he knows the halachas of the halachas that are commonly studied, as opposed to the previous one would be even where he knows the rarer halachas. According to Tosfos, that before that Masechta Kala meant the Masechtas that they learned, or the subjects that they learned before Pesach and before Sukkot, before Pesach and before Tishrei, then here we're talking about a higher level, somebody who Taka knows halacha anywhere and he's able to say. So that's the thing. According to Rashi, you would have to say that previously we were talking about somebody who has an even broader knowledge of Torah, even the more obscure areas. And here you'd be talking about somebody who knows the halachas that everybody should, that every Talmid Chacham should be expected to know. Whereas according to Tosfos, it would be the other way around. The previous one would be somebody who only knows Masechta Kala, only the halachas that they're teaching now before the Yom Tovim, whereas this one knows the halacha b'chol. So the relevance of that is to know that if he knows how to answer a halacha anywhere, then they appoint him a parnas, a leader of the tzibur. If he's only in one masechta, which means Rashi says not that he only knows one masechta, but rather that he knows how to, the current masechta that he's learning, he knows it. He knows and he can answer everything off the top of his head. Other things, if you ask him in other areas of Torah, he'd have to look into it. So then, in that case, he deserves to be ba'asre. He deserves to be appointed a parnas in his local town. If, on the other hand, if he knows in Gantz Shas, and you can ask him no matter what he's occupied with, he knows how to answer in any other place, then Reish Masivta, then that kind of person deserves to be appointed as a Reish Masivta, as the head of one of the central yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael or in Bavel. So again, Maharsha explains that this one is really the basic definition of a Talmid Chacham Gomer. In other words, when Rabbi Yochanan was going through over here, Ezeru Talmid Chacham, each one he was mentioning a particular thing. Ezeru Talmid Chacham that you return him an Aveda B'Tvias Ayin. Ezeru Talmid Chacham Shemaman and Isa Parnas Alatzib. Shemet Suvin Lassus Lamelachte. He was just saying Ezeru Talmid Chacham, period. So because the essential definition of a Talmid Chacham is that you can ask him halacha in any place and he'll be able to answer. And the only difference is it that we're talking about that he's able to answer off the top of his head only in the current Masechta he's learning, or is he able to anywhere in Shas? Okay. So the Gemara goes on to talk about, now the Gemara goes on to give this Mishnah that it had quoted before about Banoyim, which Rabbi Yochanan had said, Banoyim means Talmid Chachamim, and that led us into this discussion about the clothing of Talmid Chachamim. The Gemara gives a different definition that Banoyim over there actually means bathhouse attendants. And the Gemara calls them Ulyorim. And so the Gemara says that clothes of Banurim can mean clothes of Ulyorin, which means either it actually gives actually two explanations. Either it means bathhouse attendants, or Ulyorin is the name of a place. The point being, in other words, that those kinds of clothes were good quality, and they were, and then the Gemara talks about, they were an intermediate color. They were neither white or black. There was some color in between. So therefore, the point is, people were particular, especially the bathhouse attendants, would be particular about them, that there wouldn't be stains on them at all, not even on one side. Therefore, stain even on one side would be considered a chatzitza. So now, in this connection, the Gemara brings the question, so that's what it is. So the Gemara says, the Gemara assumes for that purpose that these kalim ha'ulyorin are white, and on a white clothing, on a white piece of cloth, you're going to notice a stain, and therefore they're makbid, and therefore yichatzitza. But the Gemara asks, Omelahu Rav Yanai Levonav, we find that Rav Yanai told his children before he passed away, Bonai, he says, my children, Altik Buruni, Loi Bekevim Levonim, Loi Bekevim Shchodim, don't bury me in white garments or in black garments. Levonim, I don't want you to bury me in white garments, Shema Loi Ezka, because I may not have the schus to be among the tzaddikim, La'asid Lavoi, Ve'ei, Kachosim, Ve'en Avelim, And then I'm gonna be among the Rishoyim. So then I'm gonna be like a chosin wearing white among the Avelim who are wearing black. Rashi points out those who are judged in Gehenna become black like the bottom of a pot. So therefore, like they're gonna be black and I'm gonna be sitting there in my white clothes and it doesn't look right. Shchurim, and I don't want you to bury me in black clothes, Shema Ezgah, because on the contrary, I might have the schos to be among the tzaddikim, ve'eyaka ovo ben chastanim. Then the other way around, I'm going to be like an ovo among the chastanim, among the ones who are happy. There is a good deal of discussion about this, by the way. I mean, so we say that the mesim get up by tches mesim in their begodim, but the famous machlokas, first of all, is that the ultimate schar? The Rambam holds that not. The Ramban holds that yes, people are going to continue living in their bodies afterwards. And there's the question also when we talk about it here about being kachosin ben avelim or ka'ovel ben chasanim. I mean, b'chalal, are we talking about, or are we talking about Rishoyim? Are we going to even have Trias and Mason such that he's concerned he might be among them? So there's a good deal of discussion back and forth about all the ins and outs of that. Anyway, so he says, instead, he says, I want you to bury me in ul yorin clothes that come from overseas. Where again, ul yorin either it means from a bathhouse or the kind of things that they use in a bathhouse, or it's the name of a place, but whatever the case, the point is, they're neither white nor black. There's some intermediate color. So the Gemara ends up answering that, yes, there's different kinds of kelim hol yorin. So certain kinds, the Gemara ends up saying, it's not brought here in Ein Yaakov, but there's a difference between levush and glima. There's a difference between the garments that fit the body versus the glima, which is more like the cape or the overcoat that a person wears over them. So Marsha explains. Now earlier in the Masechta we had there was a piece over there where the Gemara took a number of words in Aramaic and explained them as being acronyms or hinting at phrases in Lashon Kodesh or in Aramaic. Among them, where we said that levusha stands for loy busha, the word levusha, which means the garments that fit the body, stands for loy busha. There's no embarrassment. And glima, the cape or the overcoat that a person wears over that, where there you have like the you don't there's no sleeves on it or whatever. It's just like a shapeless garment kind of to cover the whole body. So glima is maloshin goyim, because the person looks like one big mass sitting inside it. So Marsha relates that over here to this Gemara over here. You have the midas that a person gets for, now a person has choymer and sura. Choymer is the materiality of a person, and sura is their neshama. So now you have midas that come from a person because of his body. So those are more like a glima. And then you have the ones that come from his neshama are called levush. So therefore, the Gemara ends up saying over here that the Gemara ends up discussing that there's a difference over here between the levush and the glimmer. One of them is white and one of them is not, and that relates to this. Rav Yanai specifically is saying to his students, he's saying he doesn't want to consider himself like a tzaddik. So what is it? Is it that he should be dressed in white, representing the midas of his tzura, of his neshama, or maybe not, on the other hand, he has to focus on he should be dressed according to the midas from his body, which are darker colored, and therefore he compromises and he says he wants to be dressed in some intermediate color. Elamaisa, eventually the minhag developed that everybody is buried in white tacharism, and that's how it is. Okay. The Gemara goes on then. So the last part of the Mishnah in this parak talks about certain dinim as far as preparing from Yom Kippur to Shabbos. If Yom Kippur comes out on Friday, which nowadays it can't, or vice versa, if Yom Kippur comes out on Sunday, what you're, that you're not allowed to prepare from Shabbos to Yom Kippur. So in that connection, it also mentions about, for example, if you have fats left over from the korbanos of Yom Kippur, can you burn them on the Mizbeach on Shabbos? And so that gets the Gemara into a wide-ranging discussion about certain dinim of Yom Kippur and Shabbos. One thing is, the Gemara mentions in the course of this discussion that you're allowed to do, you're allowed to do mekaniv, you're allowed to do mekaniv of vegetables. Rashi explains mekaniv basically means that you separate the leaves from the stalks to get them ready, that later on you'll cut the leaves and prepare food out of them. Different other mepharshim talk about that mekaniv, different other rishonim, including the Rambam, talk about that mekaniv means to remove the leaves that are kind of spoiled. Either way, the Gemara establishes that you're allowed to do that on Yom Kippur before the fast is over. So now, in this connection, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chiya Ba'aba Amar Rav Yechanan, Yom Kippur Shechal Yis B'chol, if Yom Kippur comes out on a weekday, so these following dinim don't apply on Shabbos, but on weekdays, if Yom Kippur is any other day of the week, Mefatzin Be'gozim, you're allowed to crack nuts, or Mefatzin Be'rimonim, you're allowed to cut open pomegranates, from Mincha time, from Mincha Tana, and onward, Vipnei Agmas Nefesh. Because of Agmas Nefesh, because it'll make, because of feeling bad. Now, what does that mean? Rashi actually explains that what it means is, not printed over here in Ein Yaakov, but in the Gemara, Rashi explains that the Agmas Nefesh is, it intensifies the feeling of fasting. Here you're working with food, but you can't eat it, so that makes the inui, the affliction of the fast much stronger. On the other hand, the Baal HaMor and the, a lot of other Rishonim disagree with that and say that no, what it means is that the, on the contrary, the Agmas Nefesh is like this, after, if you have to wait until after Yom Kippur to start these preparations, you're going to have to wait until you have your post-Yom Kippur meal, and you're going to have Agmas Nefesh, that your fast is lasting longer than necessary, therefore the Chamim are allowing you to do certain preparations ahead of time, so that you, so you'll be able to actually start your cooking and baking and whatever as soon as possible after Yom Kippur. And then the, so why it is that it's allowed in a mincha lemaila, so the Baal HaMor says because already at that point you're so close to being able to eat, the fast is almost over, so it's already past the salai, it's like you have bread in your basket and you're not going to come to eat from it. Different other Rishonim talk about different other reasons, including that this way it doesn't give the appearance of that you're preparing it for Yom Kippur itself, it makes it more obvious that you're preparing it for Matzah Yom Kippur. Anyway, so however, the Gemara continues, Dvei Rav Yehuda Mekan V'Karva. Now, in the household of Rav Yehuda, they would do that. On Yom Kippur, after Mincha time, they would be cutting, a cabbage. Again, Mekan V would either mean to cut the leaves off the stems, or it would mean to remove the spoiled leaves, whatever the case. And there's different other, a few different other explanations among the Shonen what Mekan V are. But anyway, Dvei Rava or Rava Gaudi Korin. In the household of Rava or Rava, they were peeling cucumbers. Also, min amin cholamayla. But given the chazur to have a komacharvi, but eventually Rabbi Yehuda and Rabba respectively saw in their households that they're starting to do it even earlier than min chaktana. Omrulahu. So they said, each one said to his household, Osir eager to mima rova mishmei Rabbi Yechanan to Osir. A letter has come from the west, meaning from Eretz Yisrael, from Rabbi Yechanan saying that's Osir. Now, even though no such letter had come, we just said Rabbi Yechanan said it's allowed, but in order to keep their families from doing an Isir, because it's not allowed earlier than Mincha time, then they said this in order that their families should accept it. In other words, if they had just told them it's Osir, their families might not have paid attention and they'd continue doing the Isurim. So therefore, in that kind of situation, they're allowed to tell them that they're allowed to tell them in the name of an Adam Gadol, such as Rabbi Yochanan, that it's Osir, even though in fact he didn't say any such thing.
What's the logic to start to do it earlier when they know they can't eat it anyway? Why start
whatever the work? Reason was, then maybe they had a lot of it to prepare and they figured they want to start early. Whatever they can, maybe they figured they still want to take a nap and late on Yom Kippur. I don't know, whatever the case, they were doing it early. But Lemaisa, there are some Rishonim who learn that it is actually Osir minat Me'ikar Adin. Others say, the Rambam brings this way, and this is how it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, that Me'ikar Adin would be Osir. However, the universal minhag became, based on this Gemara, not to do it. So in practice, all malachas that are Osir on Shabbos are equally well Osir on Yom Kippur, including these malachas. What's this doing in Ein Yaakov? Abayna points out there's a few things that we can get from this. First of all, we see from this that the importance of the affliction of Yom Kippur, that it has to be tackled. You're controlling your taivas, especially the point of Rashi, that the point is, Adarabba, you're doing this food preparation and it intensifies the inui. So that's lesson number one. Number two, that you understand that the main part of the tainus is from mincha time and on, because that's when you really feel the effects of it. Therefore, that should underscore for us how important mincha and ne'ilah and Yom Kippur are. And third of all, that we see that a person has to be moshe in his household and tell them if he sees them doing something wrong, and even as we're saying, make up something if that's what's necessary in order to get them to stop doing the issue. Moshe means to protest. The subject of this perek is what happens if a fire breaks out on Shabbos. So now, if there's pikuach nefesh, then fine, you call the fire department, you put out the fire, we're not dealing with that. The main topic of the perek is, if there's no pikuach nefesh involved, everybody is safely out, so now there's just the question, no, everything you have is going to be burnt. The Chachamim didn't want people to go and save everything that's in a burning house, because the Chachamim were concerned that then a person might be in such a panic to try and save everything that he'll forget that it's Shabbos and put out the fire. So therefore, they made various rules about what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do, what you're allowed to save and not allowed to save, and that's the subject of the first few Mishnayos of the Perek, and then it goes on to talking about what you're allowed to do to prevent the fire from spreading further and other dinim like that. Anyway, the first thing the Mishnah says is, Kol Kisvei HaKodesh Matzilanos in Adleika. All holy books, whether Torah, Nevi'im, or Ksuvim, you're allowed to save them from a fire on Shabbos, and Rashi brings from the Gemara later on, it's not brought here in Ayakar, but further on, the Gemara explains, you could even bring them out into a Mavui She'enim of Foolish. The layout of neighborhoods in those days, the typical layout was, you had a bunch of houses opening out into a chaser, a common courtyard. You had a number of courtyards like that opening out into a Mavui, a side street. And then you had the Mavui would open up into Rosh Hashanah. The Mavui, you had two different kinds, as in Erevin it talks about it extensively. You have, there was a blind alley called Mavui Sosum, and there was a cul-de-sac of a dead end, and then you had the kind that was a through street, like many of the alleys that we have here in Crown Heights, which is called a Mavui Mefulosh. So either kind, you need something in order to be able to carry in it. A Mavui Mefulosh, you need more than just a Mavui Sosum where it's only open at one end. All you need is a lechi or a koda. You need a vertical pole or a horizontal beam at the front of it. And then you also need to do a shitufa mevoyis, which is they pull together some food for it. If they don't do that, they're not allowed to carry in the Mavui. A Mavui Mefulosh needs more than that. Talks about it a great deal in Erevin. Anyway, the point is, here you have, so you have support. Suppose they're Mavui. They didn't put up a lechi or a koda, and they didn't make a shituf mavoyus. Nevertheless, you're allowed to bring the kisvei hakodesh out into that Mavui in order to save them from the fire. Usually you're not allowed to carry this to place on Shabbos, but in this case, the Chachamim relaxed that rule. The Mishnah continues: Bein shekoden behen, bein she'enin koden behen. Whether they're the kind that you're allowed to read from, or whether the kind that you read from, or the kind that you don't. What do you mean? Rashi says the kind you read from includes Nevi'im, because you use them for Haftaras and Shul. The ones that you don't read are Ksuvim. There's no public reading of Ksuvim, or at least there wasn't in those days. Nowadays, you have the Velt does Ruas and Tehelas and Shir Ashirim on the Shalosh Regalim, but other than that, though, you don't really have public readings of Ksuvim. Rashi brings from his Rebbe, Rabbeinu Halevi, that it's not just that they don't read from Ksuvim in public on Shabbos, but even Yechidim are not, even private people in their houses are not supposed to read them on Shabbos. Because this Rabbeinu Halevi, Rashi's Rebbe, explains the continuation of the Mishnah, Mipnei Bitul Beis HaMedrash. What happens is, on Shabbos afternoon, the Rav is giving a drosha on practical halachas of Shabbos, or practical halachas of whatever that are appropriate to the time of the year, and people should be coming to listen to that drosha to learn the halachas. Ksuvim are very, very interesting. Learn ksuvim sometime if you haven't yet. They're extremely absorbing and interesting. So therefore, a person is reading ksuvim at home, he's likely to be so into that, he's going to not bother going to the drosha, and then he's not going to learn practical halachas that he needs to know. So therefore, the Chachamim discouraged people from reading ksuvim on Shabbos. What are some examples of that in Ksuvim? So the five Megillas are in Ksuvim, but also many of them have a storyline. They're very interesting, but even the ones that are not, you have, for example, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Divrei Hayamim, All of those are, Eov also, all of those are very fascinating. All of those are very fascinating books to read. We find, in fact, it says, you know, in Yuma, the Kohen Gadol had to stay up the whole night of Yom Kippur, because if he falls asleep, he might become a Baal Keri. So they had to keep him up all night. And among the ways they would keep him up is Kohenim would read to him from those books of Ksuvim. They would read to him from Ezra and from Eov, Divrei Hayamim, and from Daniel, because those are very interesting and absorbing, and they would help hold his attention. So in the same way over here, Rashi explains that a person is sitting and reading Ksuvim Shabbos afternoon, he's likely to get so into that he's not going to bother going to the shiur of halacha, and that's important. He needs to learn practical halachas, so therefore the Chachamim don't want people to be reading Ksuvim on Shabbos. So it's not just that we don't read them in shul, but that private people shouldn't be reading them on Shabbos either.
They've all been translated to English, right?
Since then, of course, they've all been translated to English. Here we're talking about their original English partnership. Anyway, the point is, even though you're not allowed to read Ksuvim on Shabbos, nevertheless, if a fire breaks out, you're allowed to save your books of Ksuvim so they don't get burnt in the fire. Now, even if they're written in other languages, and Rashi explains that further on, the Gemara discusses, there may not be a heter to write them in other languages. They're meant to be written in Lashon Kodesh. You don't have a heter, at least not in those times, to write them in other languages. So nevertheless, they still require to be put in Shemus when they wear out or they're otherwise unusable. Rashi brings an explanation from his Rebbeim that the B'chol Loshen is actually referring to Ksuvim, meaning, in other words, if you have a translation of Ksuvim. However, Rashi says it seems that we know that there was a Targum for Nevi'im that was written by Yonas and Ben Uziel, but they're saying, in other words, that you're allowed to write a Targum of Nevi'im, because we see that Yonas and Ben Uziel did, but you're not allowed to write a Targum of Ksuvim. Rashi says nothing doing. Yonas and Ben Uziel didn't write his Targum down. He created it Baal Peh, but then it was transmitted Baal Peh until eventually, at some later point, it was written down. So there's no more heter to write the Targum of Nevi'im than there is the Targum of Ksuvim. So therefore, Rashi says what it means is, so whether Nevi'im or Ksuvim, any book of Tanakh, you're not allowed, there's opinions in the Gemara, whether you're allowed to write, which the Gemara is going to have in Yaakov, one piece that's relevant to this, whether you're allowed to write them to begin with in a different language other than Lashon Kodesh. But even if you did, even if you say you're not allowed to, and you did anyway, nevertheless, they require Gnizi. You can't just throw them away. You have to put them in Shemus. Now, why are you not supposed to write such? Why are you not supposed to read Ksuvim on Shabbos? Because it will take people away from being in the Beis Medrash and learning the halachas of Shabbos and other halachas that the Rav is going to dash in. Tosfos points out that nowadays we have the whole concept that Torah Sheva'al Peh is able to be written down because of Eis La'aseh La'Hashem, then therefore other Sfarim do have the same dinim as Hebrew books of Tanakh that we're talking about in the Mishnah over here, and therefore you could save them from a fire on Shabbos as well. So the same din, in other words, that we're saying over here that applies to Tanakh would also apply to Chumashim and Gemaras and other books of Torah Sheva'al Peh. Incidentally, one of this week's project Lechutas Sichas from Shavuos was that Eber was talking about the mitzvah. Why is it we have the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah, but we don't find people are doing it nowadays? You don't find most people writing a Sefer Torah or even commissioning one. And the Arichos was over there aware the Rosh holds that actually the mitzvah nowadays is on other Sfarim, because we don't learn from Sefer Torah anymore. And so the Rebbe goes into a whole analysis over there. How could you say that the mitzvah has changed? So, and how it is that, in fact, the mitzvah nowadays is to write other Sfarim, is to write, or even not even to write, to buy. You just go to the Sfarim store and you buy ready-made Sfarim. You haven't commissioned them or anything. And still, you're being a kind of mitzvah that way. Because it ever develops a point over there, the essential point is that you have them available to learn. There's no particular mitzvah that they have to be written a certain way. Okay. So the Gemara says in this connection, during the discussion about whether you're allowed to write, books of Tanakh in other languages, so the Gemara says, for example, Targum. So Amar Rav Yosi, Maisa ba'Aba Chalafta. So Rav Yosi says, it happened once with my father Chalafta. Shaholach Itzer Rav Gamliel Biribi L'Tveria. He went to visit Rav Gamliel Biribi in Tveria. Biribi, Rashi explains, means Odom God. A great Talmud Chacham is some, many times in the Gemara is nicknamed Biribi. So this is Rav Gamliel de Yavne. This is the famous Rav Gamliel that we have in many places in Mishnayos, and he was in the same generation. He was a chaver of Rav Eliezer and Rav Yeshua and that whole generation. Anyway, so Rav Chalafta one time went to visit him. He found that Rav Gamliel was sitting by the table of Yochanan Hanozer. That was his name. On the side of it, he would bring a different gift to Rav Yochanan ben Nizuf. So in that case, Nizuf or Nozuf was his father's name. Anyway, Rav Gamliel was holding a book of Targum and Iyov, a translation of Iyov into Aramaic, and Rav Gamliel was reading from it. Omale, so Rav Chalafta tells him, I don't know if you should be doing that. Zohar ani b'Rav Gamliel aviyavicha, I remember your grandfather Rav Gamliel, this is Rav Gamliel Azokin, who lived yet when the Beis Hamikdash was still standing. Shoyomid agav maila b'har habayis, he was one time standing on one of the steps in the har habayis. They view the front of Sefer Iyov Targum, and they brought him exactly this kind of book, a book of the Targum of Iyov, written in Aramaic. And he tells one of the builders over there, at that point that was still there building or renovating the Beis Mikdash, put it under the row of bricks or stones that you're building now. In other words, in that way, it'll stay there, and eventually it'll wear out, and then that'll be the end of it. So therefore, in other words, Rav Chalafta is telling Rav Gamliel Diavne, two generations later, who, by the way, Rashi points out, this Rav Gamliel Diavne is the grandfather of Rebbe, who composed the Mishnah. Anyway, so he's saying, I don't know if you should be really reading a sefer of Iyov Targum. Your grandfather, when he came across such a sefer, said that it should be left to be to wear out. So Afut Siva Olivagunza, so sure enough, Rav Gamliel also said to them to put it in shame. I said he wasn't going to read from them anymore. There is an interesting point, by the way, the Eben Ezra in Sefer Iyov says there's so many places in Sefer Iyov where it's very hard to understand the wording. He says maybe the book was originally written in Aramaic and then translated into Lashon Kodesh and then made part of Tanakh. Nevertheless, so the Gemara is saying over here, even if that's so, the fact that it was put into Tanakh in Lashon Kodesh, now you don't have a reshus to go retranslate it into Aramaic. So the Gemara continues on this topic, Tanan Abanan. They're talking further about what you're allowed to write and what you're not allowed to write. Again, this is in the time when Torah Shabbat Peh was not allowed to be written yet. So Tanan Abanan, have brochus vakameyan. Brochus, like for example, let's say you have the brochus, so Rashi says, for example, Shemana Esrei and other brochus you would want to write down as a siddur portion. Vakameyan, or kameyan, which are amulets, you write psukim or names of malachim or whatever in them for refuah. Even though they have letters of Hashem's name in them, some of Poshim say it means actual names of Hashem, others say it means, like, for example, the way we write two yuds to represent Hashem's name or things like that. Anyway, even though they have things from Torah in them, because, for example, in the Kamehim they would write psukim for refuah. And in the brachas, also many times in brachas, we have quotations of psukim. Nevertheless, ein matzivan oisim mitnei atleika, you're not allowed to save them for fire on Shabbos because they weren't supposed to be written in the first place. Elam is srofen mimukaimam hein va'azkur estehen. Rather, they just leave them to get burnt where they are, even with the names of Hashem in them. Mikan omru, based on this, the Chachamim said, kosvei brachas kisurfei Torah. People who write brachas and other things like that of Torah Shabbat Peh, that they're not supposed to, is as if they're burning the Torah. Because what happens if a fire breaks out, and fires broke out much more commonly back then they do now, then if it's on Shabbos, you're going to have to leave them to get burnt. So therefore, in effect, you cause that now this Kisvei Kodesh is going to be in a position where it's going to have to be burnt. In fact, it happened once. There was a person in the city of Sidon who was writing such things, brachas, kameyas, and whatnot. So they came and informed Rabbi Shmuel that this guy was doing that. So Rabbi Shmuel went to check out the situation. Is this guy, in fact, doing that? As Rabbi Shmuel was going up the ladder to the guy's apartment, to the guy's house, and he heard that Rabbi Shmuel was coming, he realized he's in trouble. He realized that Rabbi Shmuel was coming. So he took a tumus of brachas. Rashi explains tumus is kvutzas kuntresim, a collection of pamphlets, a collection of booklets of brachas. In English, you have the word tome, which means like a thick volume. The pashtus, it's related to this word. Anyway, so he took that b'shikon b'sefel shomayim, and he put it into a bowl full of water, so in order to hide it, like. V'loshin hazeh amalei Rabbi Shmuel, gadol onesh ha'achron min orishin, but Rabbi Shmuel said to him, using these exact words, your punishment for the second thing you did is greater than for the first one. And if it's bad enough that you wrote these brachas, which you weren't supposed to, now you've made things even worse by putting them in water, where now they're going to get dissolved and erased, and therefore you actually be a dayim, erasing Hashem's name. That's in those brachas. You can't do that. All you can do is you can leave them in an open place, and they would eventually deteriorate on their own, but not to go and actually destroy them, be a dayim. Yeah, so we're talking about Siddur. So back then, you weren't allowed to write Siddur, and everything had to be about that. Later on, again, once it came, the point, Eis Lassus, Lashem, and Feder Terasecha, there came the point when the Chachamim of later generations saw that Torah Shabbat Peh is in danger of being forgotten, so then they gradually started writing down things of Torah Shabbat Peh. So that's when the Mishnah and eventually the Gemara and eventually other things were written. The oldest Siddur we have, for example, is from the times of Rav Amram Goin, which is a few hundred years. This story over here with Rabbi Shmuel, Rav Amram Goin is like 700 years after Rabbi Shmuel. So only then, only at that time did they finally decide that it's necessary to write down the Tfilas and the Brachas, because otherwise people are going to forget them. So there's an interesting idea. It's brought about Rav Nosson Adler, one of the Rebbeim of Chassam Sofer, that he didn't write down any of his Chiddushei Torah. So the result is, actually, we have very little of his Torah, except things that the Chassam Sofer, another Talmudim of his, quote, So why is that? He said, because if the whole heter to write Torah Shabbat Peh is in case it'll be forgotten, he says, since I have a great memory, then I don't have that heter. So therefore, Yitzhak never wrote down any of his Torah. But the mainstream understanding, of course, is not like that. You're not writing it down just for yourself. You're writing it down for everybody else, and therefore there is a heter nowadays in general to write down Torah Shabbat Peh. One second, one at a time. So that's what we're saying. You're not supposed to write it down in those times when you weren't supposed to write them down. Then the result was a fire broke out. You weren't allowed to save those. That was the point of the Mishnah. You're not supposed to destroy them, be a dying, but you wouldn't save them. That was the point of the Mishnah, that only Kisvei HaKodesh do you save them from a fire. And if they're Ksuvim B'Choloshim, then they're torn in Gniza. You don't destroy them, be a dying, but you put them in the Gniza. Yeah, Amichai, what were you saying?
This week, everybody
asked
the Mechadish
Kedushim and write it down. Okay, everybody's and write them down, yeah. Because that's part of the mitzvah, writing turn, yeah. We'll continue tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gu'ola, Rosh Chodesh Sivan. We have, like this. We know on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, the Jewish people reach the ultimate level of Achdus, by Yom Hazeh Bo Midbasinah, by Yichan Shav Yisrael, and by Yichan is Loshen Yochid, because they were Ki'ish Achad B'Leiv Achad, they were like one person with one heart. And therefore, the Medrash says that's at that point, Hashem said, now the time has come for me to give them my Torah. So the point is that the Achdus that comes from the Yechida in every Yid's Neshama, the highest level of the Neshama, Yechida, that is especially connected, that Yechida is especially connected with Torah Seshama Mashiach, which is Pnimiyas HaTorah, which is the Yechida, which was given, but in a hidden way, at Matan Torah. So therefore, the Rebbe went on to say, in a similar vein, you have in every day's Matan Torah. When you say, Hareinu Mekabel Olam Mitzvah Saseh Shavah Haftal Bereich Kamaisa, and that comes right after that day's Matan Torah, because you said the Baruch HaNoisin HaTorah, in present tense, that Hashem gives us the Torah. So all of this is the preparation for the Torah Chadoshim, Iti Teitzeh, and since Achakalei B'chol Yom Shiyavu, we wait every day that Mashiach should come, therefore the time of that miniature Kabbalah HaTorah is every day. Halacha, continuing on the halachas of Birkas Ariyah. So last time we talked about if a person sees certain kinds of unusual people or animals, then you say bracha on the Mishana Abrias. Now, those we're talking about things that a person was born that way. Now, on the other hand, if a person, well, actually, so it depends. Those were all things that by definition are congenital. For example, various colors, skin, albinos, red people, etc. Now, on the other hand, if a person sees an amputee, so a person who has a leg amputated or a hand or his hands amputated, or a blind person, or a person who has boils, or a bahakon, which means somebody who has white dots all over his skin. So if he was born that way, then again, the first time you see such a person, you would say, Shana Abrius. If it happened afterwards and the person feels bad about them, then he would say the Baruch Adayana Emes, the Alter Rebbe adds, even B'Shem HaMalchus, but it would have to be that he taka feels bad for them, not just that he's saying it because that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. And the last halacha of the simon is when a person sees beautiful trees or beautiful people or beautiful creatures or even a goy. Now you're not supposed to stare at him, but if you see him and you know it and you happen to notice him or even a beautiful animal, then you say the bracha shekach aloi ba'olam. Now this is also one of those ones that you only say the first time. You only say only one time in your life unless you see one that's even nicer. And from the Alter Rebbe's Lashon is mashma, even if you see one that's nicer, once you saw one, then you don't say another bracha. So according to that, then that would be another one of these brachas that you only say one time in your life. The first time you ever see such a one that arouses a sense of beauty.
Yes,
Shikayas. Yeah.